Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're talking with Sarah Stein-Lubrano about her new book, Don't Talk About Politics. Democracy is dying, she says, because we're clinging to a dangerous and outdated myth that talking about politics can change people's minds. It doesn't. In a world where politics keeps getting more irrational, dishonest, violent, and chaotic, it's getting much harder to reach people with words alone. So people who really care about democracy must ask, how can we stop arguing and do the deep work to build stronger foundations for political life and a better world for us all? Dr. Sarah Stein-Lubrano holds a PhD from University of Oxford, a master's degree from University of Cambridge. Her thinking often reaches the public through the Sense and Solidarity Initiative and the Future Narratives Lab. She was previously head of content at the School of Life, tutored in prisons, wrote obituaries. Frequently appears on public radio and variety podcasts. Sarah Stein-Lubrano, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Did I get your name right? Lubrano?
Yes, Sarah Stein-Lubrano. Good old American mixed up name.
Okay, wonderful. So you grew up in Washington, D.C., I'm reading in the book, I think. But you've landed in England, stayed there.
Yes, I studied abroad when I was 20 years old and I liked it. So I went back, and then it was sort of an accident after that, as a lot of big life things tend to be. I did a master's degree and I thought, oh, I'll go back to America after that. And then there was a sort of interesting detour where I also reclaimed German citizenship because my grandfather was a Holocaust survivor and I visited Berlin. And in the middle of that, I got a job offer in London and thought, oh, I'll try that out for a bit, and just stayed and stayed and stayed and stayed. But funnily enough, I think this book is very American. So I think you can't take the America out of the girl, you know?
Yeah, that's true. And you wrote, I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, you write that growing up in D.C., you bought into all the, you know, the ideas that you're skewering here in the book, right?
I think I did to a degree. And I also think it's worth saying that, you know, the word ideology is a very loaded word. But at the end of the book, I talk a little bit about one aspect of ideology, which is that even when we know it is ideology and when we know it is either not accurate or harmful for us to, let's say, think through a certain lens, we will find ourselves returning to that lens over and over again. And the example that I give at the end of my book is about beauty culture, about, you know, all the assumptions about what makes a woman beautiful and valuable, and those two things tied together. And I point out that even though I, of course, being a rather progressive woman, do not believe that the value of my worth is what I look like or makeup or clothing or nails or whatever, still, I find myself frowning in the mirror in the morning sometimes, you know? And a lot of pieces of ideology work like this, that we cannot help but see things through that lens, no matter how much we may disavow it. And I would say that growing up, I certainly was more entrenched in the idea that democracy was fundamentally discourse and then voting. But I find that even now I can get stuck in that frame, and I wrote a book about it. And I think everyone is like that to some degree, because our culture is so dominant around this narrative, has a very dominant narrative about this, rather, and that ties us all in.
So you write, I thought people found truth by entertaining abstract ideas, and I think that is conventional wisdom, right? You're arguing against a couple of other big blocks of conventional wisdom.
That's true.
The marketplace of ideas and debate. Maybe let's take those in turn. I think you know, a lot of us still believe marketplace of ideas, although maybe less so these days.
Yeah, right.
Right? Let's argue it out, and the best ideas will rise to the top.
Yeah, I would say that's the rough idea of the marketplace of ideas. And, you know, in the course of writing this book, I go through the history of where that term comes from. It comes from our own Supreme Court. It's you know, quite an old phrase now. But many people have this idea that if things are just kind of left to sunlight and people debate with each other enough and discuss things enough and maybe read things online and do their research and practice critical thinking, putting these terms in quotes because they can mean a whole variety of things, then the best ideas will win. And I decided to, first of all, just put this to an empirical test, so to speak, to go and look at the political science and cognitive science of this and see if that is true. Do ideas tend to win in a marketplace? Do we see, in particular, that people change their minds on a regular basis about political issues when they're exposed to new information? And the answer is no. there is a good deal of research on this, and people do not change their minds. I particularly am struck by the evidence about watching debates. Even before this, before we started rolling here today, so to speak, we discussed the very influential debate with Joe Biden. But actually, overall, the voting averages and voting intentions are on what you know might call a random walk day today. So they go up and down, 50%, 52%, 47%. They go up and down and up and down. And when you look at the effects on the day after a debate, that random walk statistically is no different than when you didn't have a debate, which means the debate has had zero effect, zero statistical effect, or almost zero statistical effect. I cite several, very big meta studies in the book and look at different pieces of analysis about this. But fundamentally, from an empirical point of view, these debates are not changing anyone's mind. Interestingly, even the undecided voters are not having their minds changed by that, which is probably a combination of the fact that most undecided voters are not really undecided. And when they are undecided, there are other variables, we'll get into them, that are changing their minds in a far more extensive and powerful way. And so essentially, my main argument about the marketplace of ideas in debate is that they do not do what they claim to do. It's not that I don't think they would be nice if they were true, although that is an interesting and complicated question in itself, is that people do not operate this way, and they do not even seem to operate this way when you kind of clean up the process, right? I think a lot of people say, well, in the right conditions, debate or a marketplace of ideas will change people's minds. But I do not believe that because I have not found any empirical evidence for it, and also actually, there are these other variables, we'll get into them, that change people's minds far more systematically, that probably overshadow anything that the marketplace of ideas or debate could do. And additionally, I think some of this is baked into human psychology, especially cognitive dissonance, which I write about a lot in my book.
We'll get into that as well. I wonder if we could just spend a little bit of time on the we always bemoan the state of things today. I guess it may be worse than in the past, but I'm trying to think as you're talking. I'm trying to think back, right? Maybe go to the Constitutional Convention. Maybe ideas were penetrating there, right? But soon after that, you had duels and Alexander Hamilton gets killed and vicious newspaper fights between Thomas Jefferson and the Federalists. So this goes way back. You give a kind of an extreme example, but it's an interesting example, the Spanish requirement of 1513. Tell me about
Yeah,
this.
it's an extreme example, but I find that many people don't have this aspect of history because, to be honest, it's still not in our history books. When I was growing up in a relatively progressive suburb of Washington, D.C., we celebrated Columbus Day, and only now, in some parts of the states, do people criticize Columbus, a man who, in his own time, was deemed so shocking in his behavior towards the indigenous inhabitants of the Americas that he was actually taken off the job by his contemporaries, so they saw him as unacceptable. But here's an example of this, that even at the time there was disagreement about what was acceptable in the process of colonization, and people had their dissent. There was enough dissent about, in particular, the conquest of the Americas and the taking away of land from native people that eventually Spain implemented a thing called the requerimiento. And requerimiento was this little 1,000-word disclaimer that you read to the indigenous people when you met them, if you were a colonizer. I don't know why we are the colonizer in this sentence, but here we are. I guess we're going to do the reading. And the idea was that if you read them this set of phrases, then they had been given all the information and warning that they needed to behave in the way that would be appropriate and reasonable. And if they didn't then behave in the way that was appropriate and reasonable, then you could do what you wanted to. And I'm not exaggerating in any way when I say that what this 1,000-word document said was, God has given this land to the king and queen of Spain. God is real and he's our God, our Catholic God. And if you oblige us and allow us to enter, live in your space, and proselytize to us, then we won't hurt you. But if you resist in any way, then we will. And it says something like, "Do mistress to your, sorry, do mis mischief to your wives and children, and any harm that you endure is your own fault." It really says this. So it was, in a way, a kind of legal disclaimer that enabled the colonizers to say that they had done the correct amount of discourse before their domination. And the reason that I think this is an interesting, I mean, it's certainly interesting in its own right, but part of the reason I've used it in this book is that I argue that a lot of discourse actually functions like this. You know, people are in love with the idea that discourse could liberate people, that it could change people's minds. It does not actually do that right now when it comes to politics, and it probably couldn't when it comes to politics in most respects. But what it does do is provide this sense that something is working even when it's not. So for the Spaniards, they said, well, we've got this, you know, this discursive act that we engage in, therefore this is a legitimate process. And while that is an extreme example involving literal slavery and genocide, today we also have a lot of discursive acts that seem like they make our democracy functional, even though it's not.
So watching a debate, for example, you've debunked that. How about, very laudable initiatives? I talked to some people from Braver Angels the other day. Get people in a room and start talking. I don't know if you've done research on that kind of dialogue. Can that change people's minds?
Well, look, I mean, let's get into the things that do change people's minds, because the answer to your question depends on what it is they're actually doing, and I'm not familiar with this particular program, you know. There are things that do change people's minds about politics, despite what I've just said, which sounds very negative and critical, and it is in some ways. I am actually quite an optimist about many of the possibilities for democratic life together. I just believe that the things that make democracy functional look different. And once I had looked at this broad range of data about whether people arguing with each other changes people's minds, et cetera, then I began to look at, well, what does change people's minds about political issues over the course of their lives? And the interesting and beautiful and complicated thing is that human beings do change their minds about political issues all the time, not as often maybe as we might wish in certain cases, but a lot. And they primarily seem to do so for essentially one of two reasons, and I look at both in depth in the book. One has to do with changes in their network of relationships. Very briefly, one of the most powerful examples of this is the change in views on gay rights in America over the last couple of decades. That was a huge shift, maybe the largest shift in a certain issue, in any given issue in American history. And from what sociologists can tell, it happened for exactly one reason, which is that people started coming out to their friends. That was kind of the angle that this social movement took, where people would say, rather than be quietly in the closet or just keep this, you know, behind closed doors so people kind of assume it's true, you're going to come out to your friends. And what seems to have happened when people came out to their friends is that this shifted their friends' beliefs. And a lot of political change happens because of our network of relationships, because of who we know and how we learn to care about people. Our friends do not brainwash us. You can have friendships where you continue to disagree, and that happens all the time. But our friends seem to change what we think of as, important. First of all, they seem to increase the salience of certain issues for us when you look at the empirical data. And they also are very good in the right context at reducing prejudice. And I do mean in the right context. There's actually a lovely model for this in sociology, which is fits within what's called the social contact hypothesis. But just to give some examples, in order for us to reduce our prejudice over the long run, we need to be in conditions with people where they're held as our equals, right? So if they are in fact in a subordinate position to us or vice versa, we won't overcome our prejudice. But if we are held as equals by the institution, that helps a lot. Having long-form conversations that can lead to real friendships helps a lot. And having a shared goal seems to be quite important. And the reason I'm outlining these to return to your question is that it really depends on what these folks are doing. It's probably not that they're all sitting in a room and giving each other good rational reasons to believe something and then that's working, because that's the thing we don't have good data to support and lots of data that says this isn't happening, right? However, if they are creating conditions where people are held as equals, where they have shared goals and they really see themselves as having shared goals, and so on, then they might find over time that people's political views change. Because in these very specific kinds of contexts where essentially relationships are being built, then things change. And the other thing that changes our minds is our actions and experiences, but we can talk about that later.
I guess to the extent that programs like Braver Angels or others are encouraging people to find common ground, I guess what you're saying is it's not so much the arguments going back and forth, it's a relationship building
Yeah, what I
that's
tell
forming.
my organizing students is I say, it's not the conversation, it's the relationship. Where someone will often ask me, how can I have the conversation with so and so that they believe X, Y, Z? And I say, it's not the conversation. I don't care about, to some degree, I don't actually care what you say in the conversation so much as the kind of relationship you're building with that person.
Another example you give is climate. If you say if your friends get an electric car, install a device, you're more likely to do it, right? Not because they're preaching at you, it's because they did it and you trust them.
Yeah, I love this set of studies. So they did a bunch of studies trying to figure out what encourages people to take climate-friendly action in their own lives, right? And obviously this is a very important question because we're going to face truly catastrophic climate change in a number of areas of the US alone. I mean, look at the wildfires every year, right? So we need people to feel invested in this change and to do actions in their own lives. And you might think that one of the best things we could do is pay people to do climate-friendly actions or give them discounts at least on the process. That doesn't seem to work very well. You also might think you could give them arguments or reasons or even show them like big scary images of wildfires. That also does not seem to work very well. There is something that works pretty well, and that is if they see that one of their friends has done the climate-friendly action. So if your friend has installed a heat pump in their house, suddenly you might actually install a heat pump in your house more so than if you were given a huge discount on that heat pump. Fascinating, right? But it doesn't surprise me as a person who studies psychology and sociology because it really just fits in with this larger finding over and over again in social psychology and cognitive science, which is that we tend to judge what actions are reasonable and desirable by our friends for lots of reasons. We're extremely social animals, and that seems to be one of the big levers. And it's true for lots of other things, by the way. If we're going to go to the protest, it's almost certainly because of our friends. That's the number one predictor, and so on and so forth.
Let's take a brief break. We're talking with Sara Stein-Lubrano. The latest book, interesting book, is called Don't Talk About Politics. And the subtitle is How to Change 21st Century Minds. We've gotten into talking a little bit about that. We'll have more. Sara Stein-Lubrano in the book has many prescriptions of how we can change minds. And it has to do with friends and actions, right, as you've been saying. Let's take a break. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Sara Stein-Lubrano. Interesting new book's out and available now. We're talking about it. It's called Don't Talk About Politics, How to Change 21st Century Minds. Sara Stein-Lubrano has written, arguments alone have no meaningful effect on people's beliefs, and the implicit societal acceptance that they do is getting in the way of other more effective forms of political thinking and doing this. I mean, thesis of the book. Let's loop back and talk about why debate and civil discourse don't work. You're talking about cognitive dissonance. You give some very interesting examples. Tell me about this.
So this is one of the topics I studied at length for many years in my PhD. I wrote my PhD about cognitive dissonance. And what cognitive dissonance is a discomfort, probably. Psychologists sometimes argue, you know, is it a discomfort or a drive or this? Okay, but it's a feeling usually described as a discomfort when we notice a contradiction between two or more of our own beliefs or actions. And that sounds a bit like hypocrisy. It can actually come up in contexts where it's not hypocrisy. But in any case, what it leads humans to do in much of the research that is available, and this is very extensive, by the way, it's been happening for 70 years now, research on cognitive dissonance. It's withheld, you know, a lot of scrutiny because it actually pissed off a lot of psychologists. So I'm pretty confident about this research. What happens is that people notice a contradiction, often unconsciously. They can't consciously recognize it, but unconsciously they see there's a contradiction in their own beliefs or actions. And then they engage in one of two responses. And those responses kind of help explain why it's so difficult to change people's minds with arguments. So one of the responses that tends to happen quite a lot is rationalization. And rationalization is when you find reasons to hold on to your existing beliefs, or sometimes your existing behavior, but you know, you find a way to give reasons why you don't have to change. I often think about smokers. A lot of smokers I know will say, yes, I know smoking is bad for me, but on the other hand, it makes me thinner, which is good for me, so I guess it's fine. Now, what's interesting about this, besides its flimsy logic, is that, you know, that isn't good logic for what you should do with your life. But importantly, they're not saying that because they actually think, oh, yes, I'm very concerned about getting thin via smoking. It's just a rationalization. It's a cover, right? That's not why they're smoking. They're smoking because it's fun to do it. It's relaxing. They're addicted, whatever. Similarly, with political issues, we find ways to rationalize away evidence that our existing views might not be consistent, or that they might not work well, or that the people involved might be, you know, doing lots of terrible things. One of the examples I give in my book has to do with Trump supporters and how they flipped very quickly in their views on whether a felon should be president of the United States. So there were polls before and after he was convicted of several felonies, and the people involved would change their minds very rapidly. Often people who do this also don't remember that they previously held a different belief. So prior to his conviction, people said a felon should never be president of the United States. A convicted felon should not be allowed to be president. And after he was convicted, many of the same people said, oh, no, they should be. And you know, may well have said, and I've always said that, Right? And this is a common way that our brains simply deal with that discomfort. The other thing that we do is engage in something called confirmation bias, which is when we weigh the sources in our life differently depending on whether they confirm our existing worldview or not. So I do this all the time, sadly, because I'm a human, but when I go on to, let's say, X or Blue Sky, if I see someone saying something that I really like, I'll think, wow, this person's so reputable, so glad they're saying this. And if I see somebody saying something I don't agree with, I'll find a way to discredit them in my mind. You know, I'll say, can't be trusted, like wrong news site, etc. And humans are very good at using these two factors to kind of dismiss any reasons why they might rationally change their minds. And this is part of why I tend to resist suggestions that people can simply, you know, improve the democratic debate system and then we'll get somewhere good. Because unless we could change this fundamental aspect of human psychology, which is deeply rooted in our sense of our own desire to feel like we are good, meaningful agents in the world, I think it's going to be quite difficult to find a more meaningful form of debate, and to a significant degree, even discourse in general.
I'm thinking of it, a pretty spectacular example of this that just came back to me. William Bennett, who was Secretary of Education under Reagan, wrote a book in response to President Clinton. We remember his character flaws, you could call them, right? And William Bennett wrote a book, a whole book on how character matters in politics and presidency in particular. Then Trump came on the scene, and William Bennett was asked, what about your book? How do you apply that to Trump? And Bennett said, politics is a team sport. I'm supporting Trump. He repudiated his whole book. That's a pretty spectacular example of what you're talking about.
Exactly. And look, this is the one upside of this thing, is that people are very creative when they're doing rationalizations. I often think about the original cult that they studied, where they came up with a theory for cognitive dissonance. And this cult believed that the world was going to end in 1954 on Christmas Day. And when it didn't end in 1954 on Christmas Day, they came up with a beautiful rationalization and said, we've done such a good job being members of this cult that the aliens have spared us and life on Earth, and that's why we can't see the aliens. I mean, you know, it's genius in a way.
You also write that sometimes we change some of our beliefs in response to new information. And you might say, well, that's great, right? But the reason is different from what you might think, right? It's so you can hold on to other more deeply held beliefs.
We're quite good at kind of like trimming the dressings on the, you know, the main event in order to hold on to our most fundamental beliefs. And to dig into this a little bit more, one of the things about cognitive dissonance theory is that most people who use it to understand the world more or less see it as either a part of our ego defense, so part of our way of defending the sense that we are basically good people and basically competent people, right? And if you think about it, I think that's actually very important to understand, because while we all go through moments of self-doubt, it's not really feasible for most of us to walk around thinking we're the bad guys. Like there's kind of like a logic there that just can't work. I can't walk around all day being like, I'm a bad guy. You know, we need that sense that we are good, capable people in order to just get through the day and know what we should be doing. And so as much as it's frustrating that people experience cognitive dissonance around political issues, it makes sense within the context of human beings who have to operate in the world. And one of the things I wanted to do in this book is expand our imagination about other ways that we can make people better at doing politics, besides trying to fix this very fundamental thing that is perhaps not that, sorry about that noise, not that fixable.
I guess lest people accuse us of just bashing Trump, another example could be President Biden,
Absolutely.
cognitive decline, even after the debate. Some supporters were saying nothing to see here, et cetera.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, even in my own family, and I love my family. You know, I nothing about cognitive dissonance is party specific necessarily. It happens on both sides of the aisle and perhaps all the other aisles that we now are living with. And yeah, I absolutely saw this in my own family and in other people I knew who were sort of Biden supporters in a lot of ways. And they would tell me, no. You know, I remember someone telling me very specifically, the debate will happen and everyone will see that Biden doesn't have dementia and then things will be fine. And that's simply not how it went, obviously.
So, before the break, we got into some solutions or some positive aspects here. You talked about relationships being important, that the relationships can change minds, where I guess dialogue doesn't, at least not in that powerful a way. So the other piece that does change minds is actions or experiences. Tell me about this.
Yeah, great. So I have a whole chapter on how our relationships change minds, and I really focus on friendship because I think friendship is an incredibly important thing, just not just, you know, politically, but also personally. And then the other thing that there's a great deal of evidence for in terms of changing people's views in the long run in politics are our own actions and experiences. And you know, one way of thinking about this is that most people, if you ask them how people make decisions and then act, so to speak, if you ask them how people change, they'll say, oh, well, you know, I thought about it for a while and I came up with a reason to behave differently and then I behaved differently. But if you ask a psychologist, you'll often get the reverse. So many, many times when you look at psychology research, people's actions change and then their minds change after. And one of the ways that that has made its appearance in sociology and political science is that there is an ongoing field of study about what you might call gateway actions. So, you know, very small actions that have some kind of political bent or significance. And for a while, there was a debate about whether these small actions like recycling or going to a protest on the street or, you know, doing something to support migrants or whatever it was, whether those small actions kind of let people feel like they were off the hook and then they would disengage, or whether they would become more and more engaged in that political issue. And of course, it can go either way for any individual person. But on average, what the research suggests right now is that these actions tend to be gateways more than getaways. They tend to lead us into further and further, let's say, cycles of belief and behavior towards that issue. So they let us in the door. And I think this is overall pretty exciting because it means in a way that there are still lots of ways human beings think about political issues. It's just that we think through doing. We think by going and meeting the minority group that we're afraid of and then learning about them. We think by trying out how hard it is to start a business and seeing the reality of that. You know, we maybe try to reform the police, or we try to do this or that thing, and then we discover just how difficult it is or what's realistic and what's not. And I think that's an okay way, at least in many cases, of thinking through political issues, maybe better than sitting alone in your room by yourself and thinking for yourself, in quotes, you know. But in any case, that chapter spends a lot of time looking at the evidence that we change our minds because we've had experiences or because we've tried out actions, not the other way around.
You give an example of abortion.
Yes,
This is counterintuitive to me. So tell me about this.
Yeah, absolutely. It was counterintuitive to me also. So there's a beautiful, interesting book called The Turnaway Study, which actually I think all Americans should read, whatever they believe in some ways, because it's a big sociological study of what happens to women who are turned away for abortions that they want. And I'm a very pro-choice person, but I think nevertheless, there's some very interesting things to be gained from it across the aisle, let's say, because of the depth of the research. And lots of things happen to women who are denied abortions, including very bad things. But one of the things I didn't expect is that women change their minds about abortion, at least a little bit, but in a statistically significant way, when they are turned away for an abortion they want. So this study compared women who wanted an abortion, sought it and got it, and women who wanted an abortion, sought it and were turned away for some reason. Usually they've miscalculated their conception date, but there are other reasons also. And the women who were turned away for abortions that they wanted were somewhat less likely to be in favor of abortion rights in the future, which is perhaps not what progressive people like myself would imagine. They would say, oh, this person didn't get a thing they wanted. This is a violation of their rights in many respects. How could this happen, right? But there is a perfectly sound psychological logic to this, which is that on average, human beings tend to move their beliefs towards the reality of their lived experience in a lot of cases, partially for the sort of cognitive dissonance reasons that I've laid out earlier. We tend to need to, you know, collapse the space between any contradictions in our actions and beliefs for discomfort reasons. And partially because as we live a new life experience, it creates new cognitive dissonance if our previous beliefs don't align with our new actions. So in this case, many of these folks had children and then they loved the children and then they kind of moved their beliefs in line with that lived experience. And I suppose what I'm trying to say here is, you know, that a lot of political cognition actually works like this. And if we want to understand why people disagree with us, we might have to imagine the many actions that they've gone through and the way that they've navigated any potential contradictions to get to a new set of beliefs. But yes, basically, women who get the abortions they want become more in favor of abortion rights, and women who don't get the abortions they want become at least a little bit less in favor of abortion rights. Overall, they all still support abortion on average, because that is still the average belief about abortion in the United States.
You also say that people tend to bring their beliefs toward actions, even if those actions are compelled.
Yes.
And
you
give an example from climate, I guess climate actions. The government compels you to do X, and your belief follows in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the sort of like sneaky and difficult, scary stuff about cognitive dissonance. So there's a researcher who I actually just made a reel about this, so I'm very, I'm very up on this. There's a researcher called Kristen Lauren, who I got to interview for my book, and she looks at what happens when laws force people to behave in new ways. And she tries to understand whether people will kind of get on board and decide they're in favor of those regulations or they will resist them. We've probably all seen it go both ways, even in our like local environment. One of the things she found in a particularly interesting set of studies is that if the bans on certain behaviors are complete and they are they appear irreversible, people will often get on board. So she looked at bans on plastic water bottles in San Francisco. You couldn't buy, I guess, plastic water bottles. And she also looked at bans on smoking in public places in Ontario, Canada. And she interviewed people before and after, the same people before and after the bans were passed. And interestingly, she found that once the ban was passed, a lot of people who had previously told her, "I don't like this ban," literally the same people, after the ban was passed, would say, "Actually, this is fine." And they would often then do all kinds of other interesting mental gymnastics to close their cognitive dissonance. So they would say, "And I never really smoked that much anyway," you know, or "And actually, I kind of like having this new metal water bottle," blah, blah, blah. Cognitive dissonance can kind of become a force that rationalizes for us whatever it is we have to accept anyway, because it's been enforced by the government. And look, I'll be honest with you, again, very progressive person, I don't care if we can't buy plastic water bottles. I'm not that fussed. But I think this is important to notice anyway, because of course, this could be true for almost anything a government could pass. This is absolutely how many people get on board with authoritarian governments all around the world. They say, "This isn't going anywhere anytime soon. It's more comfortable for me if I decide that actually I'm kind of all right with this and maybe even a little bit in favor of it." And that is a frightening, interesting, complicated aspect of human psychology that we need in order to understand how political reasoning works.
Let's take another break, come back with our last segment with Sarah Stein-Lubrano. We're talking about her new book, Don't Talk About Politics. The subtitle is How to Change 21st Century Minds. And we'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm talking with Sarah Stein-Lubrano. Her new book, fascinating book, is called Don't Talk About Politics. The subtitle is How to Change 21st Century Minds. We've established that talking about politics, not so effective. So what is effective? Well, it's relationships and it's actions. We'll get into talking about what Sarah Stein-Lubrano suggests we do to solve these problems that are seemingly intractable. Before we get into that, I want to spend a little bit of time on your chapter on social atrophy. Fight social atrophy. This is such a problem. Of course, we're all prone to this during COVID. You give an example of when you were finishing your PhD, and there's a long stretch there where you were just, it was you and your computer. So tell me what happened here.
Yeah, so for me, what I found, and then I'll tell you about the sort of like broad research, but it's good to tell you about me first, is that, you know, there's a period of time, anyone who's done a big degree like this, solidarity with you, first of all, and secondly, there's a big time at the end where you're writing up and you're mostly sitting doing these incredibly fiddly things on a very tight time schedule in a very stressful way. So for example, I spent 3 weeks of my life where my only activity really was entering the, you know, bibliography information and double checking that I had got it right. And you don't really have time for anything else, at least in my case. And so, you know, I occasionally saw my partners, but I didn't really leave my house. You know, I barely like exercised. I just sat in front of my computer. And then there were longer periods around that time where I was just working on my computer all the time and I didn't have time for my friends. And I found some curious things happen to me during that time where I would, in particular, I became very anxious about text messaging. I would receive text messages and I would sort of interpret all kinds of like negative and nefarious things in them that perhaps in retrospect were not real. I think this person might be angry at me. This person didn't text me back. They must hate me. And I also found when I went back to socializing after my PhD that I was worse at it, by which I mean, I found it more exhausting. I found it more stressful. I found myself secretly relieved when someone canceled plans with me. It took me a long time to become sociable again. And I am on average the sort of annoying sociable person who throws several big parties a year and sees people almost every day. And around this time, I also began to do the research for the bit of the book on friendships and relationships. And I began to be interested in the effects of social isolation, because almost everyone listening to this will probably have heard somewhere that we are facing a loneliness epidemic. You know, this is the phrase that's often used. And it was extremely tightly embraced by the Biden administration and their Surgeon General. And look, the problem is that we are not facing a loneliness epidemic. Firstly, it does not have any characteristics in common with an epidemic. It's a little bit contagious in one sense of the word contagious, but nothing like an epidemic level in that sense. And secondly, we are not more lonely. Human beings do not report being more lonely than they did a couple of generations ago. That number, while concerning, because people who are lonely have all kinds of bad health outcomes, has remained more or less stable. So anyway, I became very interested in this, and then I was also having this strange moment of like social isolation myself. And eventually I got to the research on what happens when people are isolated, which is not the same thing as lonely. Anyone who has a toddler knows, you know, you can be desperate to be alone, and you can also be desperate not to be alone, and those are two very different things, right? And in short, we are not more lonely than we used to be. People don't report being more lonely. We are just more alone. Over the last 10 to 15 to 20 years, Americans in particular, we have the best data on Americans, are spending about 50% more time alone in most demographics, more hours of the day without any other human being in the room. We also report having fewer friends, although that's a sort of more nebulous metric in some ways. And we are certainly doing a lot more activities in isolated ways. So, you know, this is Robert Putnam's thesis about bowling alone. We do the same activities, but we do them without a club or a place that we belong to. We belong to fewer associations. And so we're more alone. We're not more lonely, just more alone. And you might wonder, how could this be? But this is how it works, according to neuroscientists. I've now interviewed a bunch of neuroscientists about this. They do big population-wide data on this, so I'm pretty confident about their findings within a reasonable, you know, interval. And what happens to people when they spend more hours of the day alone is that their brains change. And in fact, certain parts of their brains effectively shrink. There is a huge amount of our brain that is just devoted to social interactions. It is doing a lot every time we have a face-to-face social interaction. It's judging the other person's face. It's monitoring our own facial expression. It's trying to figure out what that person knows that we don't know and what we don't know that they know. And, you know, doing conversational pauses and maybe trying to do some humor. And that is like a full body workout for the brain. It's what we evolved to do, is have these very important interpersonal relationships and navigate them as well as possible. It's our main evolutionary advantage in a lot of ways, you know, that we can do this. And when we don't exercise our brain days to day in this way, our brain, which is incredibly plastic, constantly reformatting itself, kind of thinks, oh, you're not using that part? I'll just use it for something else. And that's very dangerous, actually, because in the long run, it leads to all the things I've just described in myself. It means that you get worse at judging social cues. You find social interactions more exhausting and you withdraw from them more. You interpret neutral cues as negative. That's the phrase the psychologists use. And something else happens that is also wild, which is we end up more in what neuroscientists call the default mode network of the brain, which is the part of the brain that's kind of, you know, like thinking a little bit as we're in the driving and don't have any music on or something, right? It's the bit of the brain that's kind of just imagining. But the problem is when you're socially isolated and you're imagining a lot, what you tend to imagine is negative stuff about the social world that you're not actually in. And so you become effectively paranoid, not paranoid in the way people who suffer from schizophrenia are, but paranoid in the sense that you begin to think that thing my spouse said to me was actually really unkind, and also that friend who didn't text me back must hate me, and I don't really like her social circle anyway. And you become far more negative about the social relationships you have. And so, as you can imagine, this creates a negative cycle. We withdraw from people, and then we see them less, and then our brains do more of this, and then our brains are more fearful and tired of social interaction, and then we see even fewer people. And this goes in a cycle. And so one of the reasons I wanted to write about this, there are many reasons. One of them is that I think this is a very different story than a story about a loneliness epidemic. A loneliness epidemic would be if we all really felt lonely and wanted to go out and see our friends, but weren't able to for some reason, and that's tragic. And that is tragic if that happens, but that's not what we're seeing. Empirically, what we're seeing is social atrophy. We're seeing people who might, in some sense, want to see their friends or have more friends, but are also deeply fearful and avoidant about it in a lot of ways and find it stressful and anxiety-inducing and don't have the skills. And the other thing is that we're seeing fearful people, and I am fairly convinced that this leads to a lot of the other sociological phenomena that are harming our democracy, particularly an increasing lack of social trust, where if you ask people, hey, can you trust the strangers in your neighborhood or in your town or your village or your state or whatever, people will say no. And once social trust declines sociologically, you see a lot of other political downstream effects. People engage in crime more, they're more fearful, they vote against, you know, any outsider groups, they hate minorities more. I mean, there's a kind of causal pathway between isolation and certain kinds of hateful and fearful politics.
So the chapter is Fight Social Atrophy. How do we fight this?
Yes, we need to fight this, yes. Yeah. And look, I don't want to be, I'm quite a careful researcher, and there's lots we can do about this problem. So it's not something to just become hysterical about. And if you have experienced it yourself, that's okay. That's part of being a human being, and it's part of something we're all going through in different ways. We all had to go through during COVID. But what we need is the infrastructure that helps us do this more easily. And in the last, 20 to 50 years, we have seen a decline in many of the beautiful infrastructures that allow people to engage in the kinds of relationships that prevent social atrophy and support democracy. We've seen the shrinking of green spaces. I just looked at a study using AI and satellites that showed that green spaces are shrinking in cities all around the world. We have fewer of these shared open spaces. Restaurants and pubs and bars are closing or becoming, terribly expensive. Public libraries are closing, and that's a very important third space. Buildings are being made into hostile infrastructures, so there's less of a place where you could just go hang out near the building or in front of the building or whatever. We're really losing the supports. And of course, organized religion with all of its complexities does offer quite a bit of social infrastructure. We're losing all the things that let us be more sociable. And then we've got the internet and our phones. So we need to build back at minimum some of these infrastructures, and also maybe put down the phone occasionally.
Yeah, right. Well, speaking of putting down the phone, you have a chapter on X or Twitter. The problems are obvious, right? It's what, as you put it, let me read this. Going on X or Twitter, it feels like as if the worst guy in the party has trapped everyone else in a one-sided, unending conversation. But we trap ourselves, right? We go there, and
we'll keep doing
we find positive things to us, right? Confirmation of our own biases, right? Sticking it to the other side, right? But these are unhealthy things. So, what would you say about X or Twitter?
Well, look, I actually, one of the things I say in this chapter is something that I think isn't said enough, because a lot of people have already said very important things about, how social media is addictive and how it is full of misinformation and how Elon Musk is a guy who, has done all of these outrageous and ridiculous things. And I say some of that in the chapter. I particularly talk about how Musk, after he bought the platform, did all kinds of tweaks to it just to inflate his own voice. So he actually had his programmers reprogram because he was mad that Joe Biden's tweet about the Super Bowl did better than his. And his tweets are now inflated by 1,000. So you see his tweets 1,000 times more than you otherwise would because he's just put some code in the algorithm, right? So there's all kinds of things going on there where, Musk claims it's a public sphere with a marketplace of ideas. And we've already kind of frowned at that idea, but he's not necessarily operating that way. And this is true for a lot of people who spout rhetoric about free speech, I won't get into that here, but there are a lot of people who claim to be supporting free speech but are actually engaged in all kinds of censorship and other nasty practices. And so that's all been said. But something I do want to say about it is that there were a lot of people who were very upset when Musk bought Twitter, and I think their response is telling, because the truth is that Twitter was always a private company, and that in America, nearly all of our media is owned by billionaires. That is the norm. That is the most normal possibility. If you look at most major TV stations, most major newspapers, even most local and state ones, a lot of the time they are owned by these conglomerates or literally just some guy who's a billionaire, like Bloomberg or, Rupert Murdoch or whoever. And that's normal. And so it was very interesting to watch people get very upset about Twitter. And I think that the reason that so many people were upset about Twitter is they felt like it was theirs. Even though it had always been owned privately, they thought, well, I am tweeting all day and I'm working on this platform and I want to think it's mine, that it's publicly owned, that it is this like beautiful piece of public infrastructure and the public square. And that is simply not the reality in capitalism, And also Musk is particularly annoying, but I think it kind of unearthed people's intuitions about what they wish the public sphere was like, and then forced those in reality to collide with A, capitalism, and B, specifically Elon Musk, who is perhaps extra bad at not annoying people as an owner.
Let's get into some, I guess, solutions. You could phrase it.
Sure.
So your thesis in the book that is words don't move the needle, but relationships and actions do. What would you suggest folks do?
Well, the two things that I tend to say, if you're not a person who's already deeply engaged in strategic activism at whatever level for the things you care about, but you want to be involved because you see that many things in our society are not working, what I would say is, first of all, let's go back to the question of social infrastructure. There's almost certainly a social infrastructure in your neighborhood that needs your support right now. And it will contribute to democracy merely to protect that. So it might be your local library, it might be your local park, it might be the PTA, it might be the playground outside of your school that is going to be shrunk. It might be that the parents in your school now sit in their cars instead of meeting with each other, and that's a problem. I mean, I'm giving you some quite basic examples, but basic is not worse. In fact, it's usually more important and better. I find that sometimes a certain kind of person who also has too many graduate degrees, like myself, tells me that what they want to do is make a, third space that is only got vegan lattes and sort of like Ayurvedic yoga and maybe a sex club upstairs. And I say, that's a very interesting project. And, I hope that you get to do what you want to do, but that's not what we need for a democracy. What we need for democracy are places where people can go for almost nothing or for free, where they can go no matter who they are, if they're disabled, if they're annoying, if they have a small child, that's what a social infrastructure is. It's a place that is really pretty much open to anyone. It is a third space in the sense that it is neither the home nor the workplace, and therefore neither particularly exclusive nor particularly hierarchical. And you can be part of building that back. This is a choice that we have. It's a choice we have to make economically about where we put our resources. It's a choice we can make individually to a degree, but ultimately we have to organize to rebuild these spaces. And only once we rebuild them will we be able to organize around other issues. And when you rebuild your third space, you will discover that there is the possibility to have the kind of relationships I've described earlier in this, hour, that allow people to think differently about political issues and in particular experience less prejudice. So that's thing one. And then, thing two is that I would say, ideally you get involved in a social movement that works towards a cause that you care about. But additionally, even before that, you might think about this question of gateway actions again for yourself and for other people. That many people think, oh, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to become more and more and more informed, and I'm going to read everything on the internet and all of the memes and all of the tweets and all of the. That's exhausting. But you know what else? It's very unlikely to allow you to think in greater depth about an issue after a certain point, and it's also very likely to stress you out. So after you do some reading, and I'm certainly not anti-reading, I would say go and try out a gateway action. You're not sure where you think about immigration? Okay, well, go and, volunteer with some migrants or volunteer with some business owners who rely on migrants or rely on not migrants. If you're not sure what you think about a certain question about gender or sexuality, go and talk to some people in a polite and friendly way. We have these gateway actions in our lives that we can always try out, and that is a form of thinking. And then if there are people in your life that you're concerned about, you can bring them along with you so they also get to try out this way of thinking. And that's a lot to get started with. You don't need more than that on public radio right now. But there's many, many things you can do after that. I think those are good starting points, though.
I wonder, are you hopeful? Going on just about any media source, public radio accepted, come here, obviously, but or social media, whatever it might be, can really suck the hope out of you. And you're saying, words are not going to change minds, and that's, blow some people's minds. But you have given us some prescriptions. Do you think of enough people adopt these ideas that the things can change?
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, this is what I would say. I am not hopeful in the immediate sense of what I think the odds are that a given thing I want to happen will happen when it comes to politics. I'm not that hopeful. I think, there are especially large structural forces working against, frankly, the well-being of most of us on planet Earth. And I am very concerned about that. But I'm not as hopeless as some others because I do believe that human beings are fundamentally capable of changing the world. We are. We get to choose every day what we do with our lives. We have changed history before by having mass movements against things that were important. We are also, I think, something that I talk about a lot in this book is that the model of human psychology that I see when I look at this research is not a subject that is only interested in their own like material interests. The people that I've described having cognitive dissonance, it's not that they primarily want to line their pockets, it's that they want to feel like agents for good in the world. And to me, actually, that's a very hopeful thing, even though it can be used in all kinds of nefarious ways. I like that model of human beings, and I like human beings even though they do many horrible things. And so I would say, while I'm not optimistic about any particular outcome in the near future, I remain optimistic about the possibilities for human beings, even if I don't think the probability that they're going to turn things around anytime soon is very high. And the other thing I'll say is a last thought. It's something that I wrote in the book at the end of the book. It's something I made a reel about and it went viral on several platforms. Is that one of the things I was interested in was this field of research on happiness. Happiness in the sense of both people rating their lives as meaningful and saying they're happy day to day. And even when you control for a vast number of variables, on average, people who are right-wing tend to report being happier and finding more meaning in their lives than people who are left-wing, which is a curious fact. And on average, the sort of centrists that write about this tend to say this is because left-wing people see themselves as victims and they have these crazy victimhood complexes. Maybe that's true, but I found a different thing, which is this is true until you look at left-wing activists. And then, much to the surprise even of left-wing activists in many cases, left-wing activists are very happy. And they're happy because they are engaged in action and relationships, right? So they have re-entered a world where they have profound relationships with other people who they're organizing with, and they believe that they can do something about the sorry state that the world is in. And I suppose my larger message about this, whether or not you identify as left or right, is that it is those actions and those relationships that make a human life worth living, and then feel meaningful and happy and important. And I suppose what I am is a profound optimist about that. For myself, of course, personally, I have many strong and important relationships and I take a lot of action in my life, but also for all of us. And I think it's possible for us to live a good life even in these unbelievably shocking and unstable times. And I hope we'll do that while also making the world actually better for other people.
Well, we've reached the end of our hour. We've been talking with Sarah Stein-Lebrun. You can find her at sarahsteinlebrun.com. And the book is out and available now. It's called Don't Talk About Politics: How to Change 21st Century Minds. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great chat.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.